But right now I'd like to welcome to the program Bruce Fine. As I said, he's a nationally and internationally recognized authority on the U.S. constitutional law, who served as the Associate Deputy Attorney General under former President Ronald Reagan. Mm-hmm. Fine was a harsh critic of the Bush-Cheney administration's violation of the Constitution and the rule of law. His latest books are titled American Empire Before the Fall and Constitutional Peril, the Life and Death Struggle for Our Constitution and Democracy. And welcome to the program, Bruce. Glad you could make time for this evening.
Well, thank you for inviting me. It's a very critical topic if we want to preserve the Republic.
Definitely. And just to introduce this topic to our audience, it was reported recently that President Obama is preparing to issue an executive order outlining his administration's policy on indefinite detention for terrorist suspects being held at the U.S. military prison camp at Guantanamo Bay, Cuba. The executive order is said to affect some 48 prisoners now being held at Guantanamo and others that may soon be transferred there under indefinite detention without charge or trial. And among the provisions said to be in the executive order are a minimal review every 6 months and a more lengthy review of the indefinite detention status of these detainees annually. And I'd like to get your overview right now, Bruce, of this presidential executive order and how this changes the situation that President Bush put in place when he was president.
Well, it really does not. In fact, my recent book talks about the Bush-Cheney-Obama philosophical triumvirate when it comes to national security matters, trumping due process and all other values. But I think for your audience really to understand the significance of this particular proposed executive order, I need to give a little bit of a background of the legal landscape following 9/11. There are those who have been charged with crimes who were involved with 9/11. Mr. Moussaoui is one. He was so-called the 20th hijacker. Others are charged with crimes, membership of Al-Qaeda. Jose Padilla was one, who have been tried in civilian courts. And the civilian courts have the trappings of due process. You have right to a jury trial. You have an impartial, independent judge. You have right to confront and cross-examine your accusers. You need proof beyond a reasonable doubt and that sort of thing. And the record in prosecuting those allegedly associated with Al-Qaeda is mixed. We have convictions. Mr. Moussaoui, life imprisonment. We have Mr. Padilla. I think he's under 20 or 25 years in prison or whatever. Those are simply the customary application of civilian criminal code to those who were implicated in 9/11. And there have not been difficulties in prosecuting the cases, in large part because of a 1980 law called the Classified Information Procedures Act, which enables the government to prosecute cases that could imply classified information if they provide an adequate summary that lets the defendant be informed fairly of what the charges and evidence against him are. Indeed, Michael Chertoff, who was at one time the Secretary of Homeland Security, was a U.S. prosecutor, has testified before the Senate that the civilian courts are completely capable of trying these terrorist cases implicating Al-Qaeda or other terrorist organizations. So that's one route. And the audience knows probably about the proposal that Attorney General Holder made to try colleague Sheikh Mohammed, the so-called mastermind behind 9/11 in the civilian court in New York City. And then he ultimately flinched and said, oh, well, we really can't do that. He's still in abeyance, and no one knows exactly what will happen to him other than the fact that he is also being held as an enemy combatant, meaning one of those indefinite detainees Obama is referring to, who may never get a trial, never be accused of anything, but sits without any due process of law in life at Guantanamo Bay. But anyway, that's one group, those who have been charged with crimes, and obviously if you're involved with any Al-Qaeda violence, you're providing material assistance to a terrorist organization, which is a crime under civilian law. Then there's another category of those who are allegedly guilty of war crimes. And if you're in that category, you can be tried before a military commission. A military commission is within the executive branch. The executive branch plays judge, jury, and prosecutor. It basically has none of the trappings of due process that you get in a regular civilian trial. No right to cross-examine the evidence against you. You don't have an independent judge. You don't have a trial by jury of peers. You can use evidence that's obtained by coercion. You don't have the right to call witnesses on your own behalf. It's really something akin to a kangaroo court. And military commissions have tried 5 individuals over the last 9 years. None of them have been very eventful. In some cases, the defendant pled guilty, and these were the charges of providing material assistance to a terrorist organization, the same charges that also can be tried in civilian courts. One individual, David Hicks from Australia, received a 9-month prison term. He served it in Australia. Mr. Hamdan, who was the driver of Mr. Osama bin Laden, got 5 months. He's already been freed. These have not been very punitive sentences, in part because the accused had such marginal roles at all in any of these terrorist organizations. So that's the second category. Those allegedly who have committed war crimes get tried for military commissions. The third category is enemy combatants, the ones that you have referred to. They're the ones who remain at Guantanamo Bay, who are neither charged with a crime nor given any trial. They're just said under the law to be affiliated or associated in some way with the perpetrators of 9/11. Now, affiliated and associated doesn't have, they don't have, you know, delimiting principles. Now, does affiliated mean you are affiliated philosophically, perhaps believing like Al-Qaeda, you may be opposed to the war in Iraq or Afghanistan? It's a very open-ended concept. And it basically throws us back to the days before Magna Carta and King John in Great Britain, 1215, by enabling us, the executive branch, unilaterally deciding to detain someone for life without any judicial legislative oversight. It's just the executive branch decision on their own. It's very important also to the audience to recognize that the vast majority of the decisions for detention at Guantanamo Bay have proven to be erroneous, even under the broad standard of enemy combatant. That is, the Department of Defense on its own has released hundreds of individuals concluding they weren't enemy combatants. In other cases, when the Supreme Court held in 2008 that they had a right to go to federal court to prove they were not enemy combatants, the government loses the majority of cases. So the error rate is very, very high, underscoring the importance of some procedural protections against injustice. I was involved in helping 17 Uyghurs. Uyghurs are Muslim Turkic ethnics in northwest China who have been fighting for autonomy for long years. 17 were picked up on the fields of Pakistan after 9/11, fleeing their training grounds in Afghanistan, held for over 7 years as so-called enemy combatants. When they finally got to a court hearing, the Department of Justice said they had no evidence that they were enemy combatants and said they shouldn't have been detained, but you can't release them in the United States because they're illegal aliens. They don't have proper documentation, so they have to stay incarcerated at Guantanamo Bay. A truly Orwellian remark, if there ever was one. And the result was the case got up to the U.S. Supreme Court. The Obama administration then raced to bribe countries to take the Uyghurs off their hands, which was successful. They ended up in places like Bermuda and Palau. Those countries that didn't worry about the Chinese buying their bonds, I guess, because the Chinese government despises the Uyghurs. They view them as traitors and opposed to the majority Han Chinese that dominate the Chinese political landscape. But anyway, that's an example. The Uyghurs are how vulnerable the detentions are to inaccuracies and injustices, underscoring the need for judicial review and outside examination of the matter. So that's where we are. The total number of detainees at Guantanamo from 2001 onward ranges in the neighborhood of 900 to 1,000. And say we're now down 48-50 remaining detainees. A large percentage are from Yemen. And this executive order purports to address those. Now, the executive order really is a very minor tinkering with the status quo. That is, under Bush, a system called Combatant Status Review Tribunals was created to determine whether or not those who were detained at Guantanamo were indeed enemy combatants. It was a very fragile tribunal, if you will. The government's decision was viewed as presumptively correct. The detainee wasn't really given any notice of why he was viewed as an enemy combatant, simply asked, well, tell us why you shouldn't be an enemy combatant, without knowing any of the evidence that the government was relying on against them. The detainee couldn't offer evidence and witnesses in his own behalf. And so that system is the one that Obama is tinkering with. Perhaps his greatest flaw is structural. The founding fathers described the combination of judge, jury, prosecutor in a single branch as the very definition of tyranny. And that's what these tribunals are about. That is, the executive branch is judging the correctness of its own decision to capture and detain someone as an enemy combatant. And you can imagine the likelihood that they're going to find against themselves is very tiny. That's why we have in the ordinary due process system a requirement that an independent judge decide your case, not a member of the prosecution staff overseeing the prosecution deciding whether his subordinates got it right. But that's what Obama is tinkering with regard to this executive order. I think it simply shows that other than a few commas and semicolons, he and Bush and Cheney are on the same page.
Bruce Fine is our guest, Bruce Fine, I wonder, when you look at this executive order, how does it interact with the Supreme Court decision of 2008 that gives Guantanamo detainees the right to challenge the lawfulness of their detention in federal court? It seems that this executive order will twice a year allow detainees at Guantanamo and their lawyers to examine the evidence against them in order to determine whether they're justly being held indefinitely. Again, a lock without a key, so to speak.
Well, I don't know whether it will affect very much. It may be the Obama administration will tell the courts that they should wait till the executive branch undergoes these examinations internally to take a habeas corpus case. I don't think that will be successful. It may well be, however, that the government itself will, in the process of running these combatant tribunals, have established better cases to defend when they finally get to federal court. But there's another element here, this catch-22 that I've neglected, that's very important, and that is that the Obama administration, as well as the federal courts, have taken the position that if it is decided to transfer a detainee from Guantanamo to Bagram prison in Afghanistan, which has been done, then there is no habeas corpus right. So if habeas corpus proves somewhat damaging or vexing to the administration, they can just take the detainee and ship them to Bagram and wipe their hands of it like Pontius Pilate and say, well, you can stick there in a dungeon for your life and you can't have access to any court whatsoever. So it shows how far we've come from the Republican values and the notion that due process was, you know, the earmark of the United States, a recognition that the government and individuals can get it wrong. There's a dignity in providing everyone a day in court to establish their innocence. And that's what makes us different from tyrannies and dictatorships, where all that is important is that a political power from the top be exercised to pulverize anyone who would dispute their right to rule.
Bruce Fine is our guest tonight. He is a nationally and internationally recognized authority on U.S. constitutional law, who served as the Associate Deputy Attorney General under former President Ronald Reagan. Bruce, when you look at Congress, Congress made a law where they don't provide funds to transfer Guantanamo detainees to the United States to stand trial in civilian courts or to repatriate them if they are found to be innocent and there's a need to release them. How do you view this legal limbo that the people who are found to be innocent are now going to be placed, in which they can't get a trial, they're not going to be even charged, some of these guys, and if they're found to be innocent, they cannot be released, and there's no funding to bring them here to the U.S. or other places.
Yeah, well, you know, maybe Franz Kafka perhaps would have had fun with this kind of situation, and it's not humorous because it relates to people's lives and liberties here. You're speaking of the National Defense Authorization Act for fiscal 2011, which the President Obama signed just about a week ago, and it states that Congress is prohibiting the use of any funds not only to transfer any Guantanamo detainee to the United States for trial, but also to release them. To release them because either the executive branch or the judicial branch has found that they're not enemy combatants. So we now have Congress ordering the incarceration of people simply because at one time there was an error in believing that they were an enemy combatant, which is a monstrous violation of due process. If there's any way that it can be challenged in court, it's, in my mind, clearly will be held to be unconstitutional, and shows you how the fraud that is being perpetrated by the American people when you have the Congress saying, well, now we're going to recite the Constitution, and we're going to read it, and every day we're going to we'll set forth the constitutional provision that justifies what we have done. Well, I can tell you they don't have any constitutional authority for that, and they surely do not understand the first inklings of due process, the most important concept ever invented in the history of civilization, the recognition you can err, that you have to have process to prevent injustices, and you have to have process in order to treat persons with the dignity they command as human beings, even if you disagree with them and decide ultimately that they shouldn't get their way. And that's something that I think the incoming members of Congress will find to their chagrin. They will not find constitutional authority for the things they think are in the Constitution. I was perhaps more shocked than any time in my life, and I've been shocked a lot of times, been in Washington 43 years, when I heard Peter King. He's a member of Congress from New York who will be the chairman of the Homeland Security Committee in Congress, state that it just wasn't right. You couldn't have civilian trials where you couldn't ensure guilty verdicts after one accused terrorist implicated in the Tanzania and Kenya bombings of our embassies in 1998 was convicted on one conspiracy count but acquitted on many of the others relating to a murder, and he was just outraged that a court would let a jury come back with a not guilty verdict. Like, that violates, you know, the rights of Americans to think that you can be not guilty once you're charged. And this, if it wasn't so preposterous and terrifying, you know, it would be a product for a Peter Sellers play or something like that.
Right.
This is the chairman of the Homeland Security Committee. We don't have trials unless we know we're going to get guilty verdicts. What does that sound like? It sounds like Vladimir Putin and Mr. Kofsky in Russia. But I thought I would live in the United States, not Russia.
You know what's worse, and we talked about this briefly before, is that President Obama's Attorney General, Eric Holder, before Congress, when he was grilled by legislators about what would happen if there was a civilian trial for one of these terrorist detainees and they were found innocent, Holder basically said, well, we just won't release them. We'll keep them in prison for life. Yeah, this was in reference to some of the quote-unquote high-value detainees like Khalid Sheikh Mohammed and those guys.
Yeah, well, that's right. And see, that's what the situation is in the sense that all those who are accused of crimes are also being held simultaneously as enemy combatants. So if they're not being held as a convicted criminal, we just said, okay, now we're holding you as an enemy combatant. You can substitute one for the other. So if you get acquitted on one, you get detained on the other one. So all this is really just sound and fury signifying nothing.
Well,
and it just makes the foreign world contemptuous of our so-called sanctimony about rule of law and due process and fairness. Because we violate it every day when we find it convenient for us, and then we have the audacity to lecture other countries on how they need to step up with due process and rule of law.
Holder's admission really, was the definition of a show trial. We're going to put this guy on trial. Then this was supposed to give the United States credibility about the rule of law in force here. But he basically said these trials will count for nothing if we don't get the verdict we want, which is what we just talked about. We're running out of time. Bruce Feinite, I have one last important question for you to discuss, and that is, President Obama campaigned for the presidency, saying that he would reverse many of the Bush administration's breaking the Constitution, violating the Constitution and the rule of law in this country. When he got into office, he pretty much did the opposite. He clung and embraced, as it's been said, many of the Bush administration's violations of civil liberties that he once decried. What course of action can the country take to really try to reverse this stuff? Are we going to have to wait for the Supreme Court to get a very solid case to find out what happens here? Or the Supreme Court, of course, in their conservative majority, may not see it the way a lot of citizens who are concerned about civil liberties see it.
Yeah. Well, it's an excellent question, and unfortunately I don't have a perfect answer, but I have some. One, it's a little bit worse than you've described, because at least with regard to claiming state secrets to block those who have allegedly been victimized by United States torture or even assassinations from recovering damages, the Obama administration has gone further than Bush Cheney. Secondly, it was the Obama administration who introduced this idea that we really shouldn't have Miranda warnings for anyone accused of international terrorism anymore. This was after the Farouk Abdul Muttalib incident in Detroit with the airlines. So he's proposing now to water down the Miranda warning, something even that the Bush administration did not contemplate. But you say, well, what ultimately, you know, can happen and to change these things, to reverse things? Number one, I agree with you. Reliance on the U.S. Supreme Court is a very fragile reliance. The history of the court over 220 years is, in the long run, they can put a few speed bumps in the road, but they're going to back down to prevailing political, conventional wisdom, etc. Even during World War II, we had flagrantly racist concentration camps for Japanese Americans. Case got to the Supreme Court, and they affirmed the racism. They had said it started out with racial distinctions are odious to a free people. And as you figured, oh, wow, this is going to be a great decision in favor of civil liberties, but the court then flipped and said, but, you know, this is different because Japanese have undiluted blood strains to Hirohito, the Emperor of Japan, and whatever, quite a racist decision. But it means that the American political culture has to insist that they will not vote, the voters will not support candidates for Congress who will tolerate a president doing these things. You know, there's nothing that prevents Congress at any time for impeaching a president, and I supported the impeachment of Bush and Cheney for doing this, for what you would call crimes against the Constitution. It doesn't have to be a federal criminal offense. And members of Congress need to accept that responsibility. Otherwise, limits on the president are toothless. That's what was so damaging when Nancy Pelosi, shortly after the Democrats regained control of Congress in 2006, was a disaster in saying, well, impeachment's off the table, before it became formally sworn in as speaker. Meaning, all right, now if you're the president, the vice president, you can do anything you want. You know, we'll just watch as spectators. And it's going to be a long process. We cannot believe in a Pollyannish way that our political culture will turn around at any time soon. My book describes the psychology of empire, where the culture readily succumbs to the ability of leaders to frighten us into thinking that a caliphate is around the corner unless we tolerate all these encroachments on civil liberties and due process, and that we can actually come to a risk-free life as long as we have military projections all over the planet, 135 bases, hundreds of thousands of troops abroad, and that kind of thing. It's ultimately up to our civic culture to reject this idea of empire, to return to our Republican values, where we want our influence abroad to be influence of example. The influence abroad is not by military force, by example at home. We build a strong defense against any aggressor. We have a retaliatory capacity. We're not isolationists in the sense that we keep diplomats and we keep intelligence collection. But as John Quincy Adams, our sixth president and then Secretary of State, said in 1821, we do not go abroad in search of monsters to destroy. We could become dictators of the world, but we would destroy the republic in the process, because all power would migrate to the executive, and in times of war, there is no law. That's what we've got to return to, those values preached and practiced by the founding fathers for some 70 years or more, until the Mexican-American War started us down the descent towards empire. We can't leave it to others. History is biography. It's you and me and all us citizens. We've got to get the thrill of self-government back. You know, we don't want to be vassals. We may make errors, but there are errors, and we'll be accountable for it. That's the attitude that created 1776, the Constitution of 1787, and when it returns, I think our problems will finish. But until that time, no, I do not see the members of Congress or the President by spontaneous combustion suddenly becoming enthusiasts for the Constitution.
Unfortunately. We're out of time, Bruce Fine. Thank you so much for all that you do to really go after and challenge the fear that drives people to embrace this kind of tyranny and violation of our Constitution and our democracy. And I hope we can invite you back soon to talk more about the issues of empire. We're going to be broadcasting an interview I did before a couple of years ago with Chalmers Johnson, who wrote quite a bit about that. But I'd love to have you back to talk more about your recent books on the topic of empire, and I hope we can arrange to do that soon.
Chalmers, when he was teaching Asian history, the Chinese, Japanese, when I was a very young, a callow fellow in college. So there's that, yeah, that commonality. And I read Chalmers' books, and he certainly has got it right. I think we're in the same philosophical groove.
Well, Bruce, thanks again for making time for us. And again, we'll try to get you back here soon to talk more about that.
All right. Good luck. Thanks, Scott, and your viewers and listeners.
Thank you, Bruce. Bye-bye. That was Bruce Fine, recognized authority on U.S. constitutional law, who served as the Associate Deputy Attorney General under former President Ronald Reagan. And his books include American Empire Before the Fall and Constitutional Peril.